everyone, and welcome to another monthly installment of the Student Press Law Center podcast, a rundown of legal developments affecting the rights of student journalists across the country. I'm Frank Lamani, the executive director at the Student Press Law Center. The Student Press Law Center is an advocate for the legal rights of student journalists. We're online at splc.org, and you can send your legal questions to us via email, splc@splc.org. This month, we're talking about the legal status of college student publications, and in particular, how those publications exist in the shadow of the U.S. Supreme Court's 1988 ruling in Hazelwood School District versus Kohlmeier. In that case, the Supreme Court deprived students at K-12 public schools of meaningful First Amendment protection when they publish in the curricular setting. The justices left open the question of whether college students would be governed by the same level of control, speaking in a very different context. Is there a way for college students to gain meaningful First Amendment protection, to structure their programs in such a way that they're insulated from image-based institutional censorship? Well, our guest this month says, yes, that there is. Our guest is Nicole Comparato. She's the editor-in-chief of the University of Miami Law Review. She is also a former editor of the Daily Tar Heel at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill, which is one of the best and most independent of college student newspapers in the country. I should also say that upon her graduation, she's going to join the Weil Gotshal Law Firm, an excellent firm with which the Student Press Law Center has worked on a number of pro bono cases over the years. Nicole has just published an article in the Miami Law Review, Combating Institutional Censorship of College Journalists, the Need for a Tailored Public Forum Category to Best Protect Subsidized Student Newspapers. So thanks so much for that valuable article. Please get us started by explaining, where did your interest in researching the subject start?
Thank you so much, Frank, for that introduction. I just want to say first, thank you for having me on the podcast. It's such a great opportunity to talk about college media rights, and I feel very fortunate to be able to contribute to this discussion. Just to start out, I, of course, have been interested in college press since I worked at the Daily Tar Heel. We were pretty fortunate there because, of course, we were independently funded completely through advertising, so fear of censorship from the administration was never really plausible, at least in our view, although we did receive some pressure, as I think all college newspapers do. But I first became interested in this topic after attending many different college journalism seminars and conferences throughout my time at UNC. And of course, Hazelwood is one of those dirty words that you hear about constantly in the college journalism world, and we get to learn a lot about the case and how it does pose a threat to college media. But where I particularly found my interest in this topic was attending a management seminar for college newspaper editors. It was held in Athens, Georgia back in 2013, and we had about 50 to 60 college newspaper editors from around the country that attended. And it was sort of my first exposure to other college newspapers, at least working very closely with their editors. And it posed some interesting questions and discussions among us because we all had very different papers. Some of us published daily, some of us weekly, some of us were completely independently funded, and some were completely funded by the school. And what I ran into was some alarming conversation, especially from the subsidized student newspaper editors-in-chief, about the pressure, and not only pressure, the threats to cut funding to their newspaper that they were facing if they ever shared or wrote an article or an opinion about something that would threaten the university's image or anything that the university considered bad press. To me, this was truly appalling. I mean, of course, you know, we receive emails and calls from administrators at UNC, and they had questions and they wanted certain coverage from us that perhaps we didn't give them, or they didn't want some coverage we did give them, but we never received any threats to pull funding because we just simply didn't have that threat. We were completely self-sufficient. So for me, that was completely astounding that these college journalists would be threatened by their administration and not be able to publish what is true and accurate and fair, mind you, reporting of some of the, you know, negative sides of their university for fear of losing their funding. So that was a really big eye-opener for me, and that's when I first became interested in this topic. Of course, at the time, you know, I shared my sympathy with them, and we discussed how our roles were different, but they faced many different challenges during their year as editor-in-chief that I didn't necessarily have to face. So part of earning your candidacy on the law review here at UM is you have to write a student note. So for me, it almost clicked immediately. I said, okay, I want to go back to my journalism roots. Let me write about something that I'm truly interested in. So when I started my research, at first I thought, you know, I'm going to write an article about Hazelwood and how it's decided incorrectly and it should not apply to college newspapers. There are actually quite a few articles out there about that topic. So I thought, you know, maybe there's something a little bit deeper to this.
Yeah. So let me ask you to focus on the public forum issue that you spotlight in this article. When Hazelwood was decided, it was based on what was then sort of a new innovation that the Supreme Court had recognized in the doctrine of the First Amendment, this idea that government property could be divided into different kinds of forums, and your right mm-hmm. to speak on that property depended on what type of a forum it was. In the view of the Supreme Court, a student newspaper at a high school was not a public forum and therefore entitled to the lowest degree of First Amendment protection possible, and that's how they got to that result. Now there's the question of what type of a forum a college student publication might be, and as you point out in the article on the University of Miami Law Review, there are differing decisions on this from the lower courts. Talk a little bit about the confusion surrounding this notion of a limited public forum, a designated public forum, and how challenging it has been to arrive at a coherent understanding of that.
Absolutely. When I started looking into the public forum doctrine, at a very basic level, the main categories made sense. So there's traditional, designated, and non-public. And traditional is, of course, afforded the very most protection. But it's pretty clear that college newspapers aren't traditional public forums because those are typically public streets and public convening areas that are open to free speech at any time of the day. Designated public forums seem to be more of the wheelhouse we were looking for in terms of college newspapers. That's a forum where the government has intended to open up a particular space to either the general public or a specific group of people, and any content regulation would be held to the same standard as a traditional public forum. So there's very high protection in designated public forum. And, of course, non-public forum is what the Hazelwood Court found was the spectrum in that case, and that's a rational basis test that scrutinizes very well. The confusion is, over the years in the public forum doctrine jurisprudence, there's emerged this fourth category, right, the limited public forum. And the reason it's confusing is because some courts equate it to the designated public forum, which affords it obviously very high protection and subjects any content regulation to strict scrutiny. But then some courts equate it to the non-public forum, which we know is a much lower level of scrutiny. In fact, during my analysis and sort of research into the public forum doctrine, I met with several constitutional law experts here at UM, and several of them use limited public forum synonymous to non-public forum. And I thought, if we can't nail it down in this room with a few experts, how can anyone else be expected to? So that was really my journey in trying to figure out what the limited public forum is, and is this something that we would want college newspapers to be defined as? And the most confusing part of it all is there are two really big college media cases that have come out in the past, and then actually the most recent one now is over 10 years old, so really not that recent. But the first one was Kincaid v. Gibson, which was a Sixth Circuit opinion in 2001. This is now considered a win for the college media community, but it wasn't back then, because at first, in 1999, Sixth Circuit found that the college yearbook at issue in that case was a non-public forum, which set off a frenzy, and people were furious, and actually the court decided and ruled en banc that it was a limited public forum. Now, why is this considered a win? Because in that case, the court equated limited public forum with designated public forum. So they were saying that here the administration had opened up this yearbook for complete editorial control by the students. The students had all the decisions. The written policy said so. Their practice showed that there was no real direct oversight in the advising, and so that was a limited public forum. But the problem is, we know that that's not exactly how everyone defines limited public forum. So in deciphering the case, yes, it was a win for college media, but when you're using that vocabulary interchangeably and describing it with non-public forum, that's not very helpful to our future questions. In addition, that case also stressed the written policy of the school. And my real issue with that, and this is my whole issue with the designated public forum category in general, which I can get to in a minute, is that the court really emphasizes the written policy of the school. So my question is, when it comes to balancing the written policy of the school and what's in the handbook or in the student guide versus the actual practices, who's running the page on a daily basis, who's approving editorial decisions, which is going to be weighed in more favor? A lot of scholars say that the written policy is what's going to be weighed more heavily. So even if we have, you know, intentions of making college newspapers editorially independent, even though they're funded by the school, with a designated public forum, it's still a bit iffy. Actually, the worst case for college media, I think, personally, was the Haas v. Carter decision, which was just 4 years later in 2005, that was released by the Seventh Circuit. This case was just, I mean, you'll have to, in my note, I go quite into details of it, but basically the court engaged in sort of a hypothetical marathon in terms of describing scenarios where a college newspaper, and the case determined it was about a college newspaper, not a yearbook, so this was very on point. It went through exercises of determining whether a college newspaper was, you know, a non-public forum, if it was funded by the school and you were writing articles about the school and so on and so forth, versus it being a designated public forum, and when was it, you know, can it change? Is the funding affected? It was this really complicated, convoluted analysis. And ultimately they decided in that case that the college newspaper at issue was a designated public forum. But get this, they called it a limited purpose public forum. So that's more words to this confusing vocabulary game. And they said the editors were empowered to make their decisions without fear the administration would stop the presses. But that case, the way that it turned out, is they decided that the dean who had censored the newspaper was released from liability completely on a qualified immunity basis, which meant that the court said there was not enough clarity in the case law for a person in the dean's position to understand how he should act. So we should give this dean a free pass because the law is just much too confusing. That, to me, was the biggest red flag that screams there is an issue with the public forum doctrine. I mean, if a case comes out and says, yeah, this was an editorially independent newspaper and they should not have been censored by their administration, but we're going to cut the administration a break because who could understand the law anyway? That, to me, is a very big problem.
Right. Just to elaborate a little bit on the confusion surrounding public forum status, some folks may be familiar with, this is now a case that goes back 5 or 6 years, a high school case at Ithaca High School in New York. It was one of the more recent iterations of public forum doctrine in the circuit court, in a case called the Oxhorn versus Ithaca Schools case. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals sided with a school that censored a student editorial cartoon mocking the ineffectiveness of the sex education program. And in getting to that result, the court decided that the student newspaper was, using the term that Nicole has just explained to us, a limited public forum, but then went on to say limited public forum, in our judgment, means limited to the categories of speech that the school decides are appropriate at any given time. In other words, no protection at all. Once you determine that the decision maker has the ability on a case-by-case ad hoc basis to decide which categories of speech are suitable and unsuitable for the audience, then it is no forum at all. It is cases like that that have made many of us skeptical of whether limited or designated public forum means much of anything at all anymore. So you propose a different way of looking at this, a different analysis that in my reading of it looks like you would actually be giving some teeth to the concept of what we always kind of thought and understood a limited public forum to be, but you'd actually make it meaningful under the law. Talk about the standard that you're suggesting.
Exactly. And that was really my goal in formulating this argument here. I thought the concept behind a limited public forum was a good one. And in theory, it was supposed to be a designated public forum that has been limited to a specific group of speakers. And once it's been limited to that group of speakers can control whatever is published or whatever is released in that type of forum. And so content regulation would be subject to strict scrutiny. I think that was the original intention for a limited public forum, and I don't know where it got lost in the history of cases and where the courts went wrong with this, but it seems that it's just taken on a mind of its own. And just because of the confusion, I think we've passed a point where it can be saved. I really don't think that a limited public forum can be saved. So in coming up with this sort of new forum that really isn't that new, it's just more clear, I thought the tailored public forum would be an accurate description of it. I think that the public forum name should describe exactly what it's doing. In my view, a tailored public forum would be tailoring the group that it's meant to express in the type of forum. So here in the college newspaper setting, we'd be tailoring it to the group of students that run the newspaper. And of course, I make the caveat in my article that any staff-approved guests as well, because, you know, that could bring a whole storm down on a college newspaper where the administration says, yeah, the students could have published whatever they want, but you can't bring in this guest speaker who speaks out and so on and so forth. So my view is that you tailor it to a group of students, and then any content regulation is subject to strict scrutiny. And I really think that because of the importance of college newspapers, we shouldn't settle for anything less than strict scrutiny. The case you just described about the cartoon that was censored in the Second Circuit, to me, that's not a limited public forum. That's a non-public forum. A non-public forum is where a state can regulate subject matter and speakers so long as the regulation is reasonable in light of the purpose of the forum. So it sounds like if they were saying that, you know, it's restricted to certain categories, they already limited the purpose. So they may be passing it off as, you know, a better name just to perhaps not make it sound as harsh, but they created a non-public forum with their limited public forum. So to me, there's just too much confusion in this area. I also think the designated public forum was a great concept, but because of the discretion and the weight on the government's arguments in that sense, I just am too skeptical to say that we should rely on that as well. I think that if we have a tailored public forum, it will be automatically assumed that it's been limited and that the policy and practice are the same, that this forum has been opened for expressive activity that cannot be regulated by any administration or any government actor. What's particularly concerning is the Supreme Court said in the Cornelius case, which is another case that talks more recently about public forum, that we will not find that a public forum has been created in the face of clear evidence of contrary intent. So perhaps a school is exercising their practice and running their newspaper on a daily basis, but if the court found the original intent was that the school didn't mean to set it out as a public forum at all, then that's going to weigh against their analysis, and I think that there's just too much leeway there. So I personally think that the tailored public forum is the best of both worlds, the designated and limited, what the court probably intended to create it as, and the monster has become in the recent years. I think that this can clear it all up.
This makes really good sense as a resolution to this confusion that has bedeviled the courts, including our own Supreme Court, which has had difficulty sometimes using those terms, designated and limited public forum. Sometimes mm-hmm. they're treated as synonymous and interchangeable. Sometimes they're treated as meaning distinct things. So I think that's a really smart take on it. Just by way of conclusion, let me ask you the practical question. How would we get to that position? We know that student journalists think that more protection is better than less. We know that student journalists and their supporters believe that their work should be insulated from college censorship. How would we get the legal community of potential opponents to come around to embrace this kind of a legal standard?
I think the goal is just to continue to communicate the value of student newspapers. And I know that's sort of a very optimistic view of it, but unfortunately, you're right. I mean, there's no indication that the Supreme Court is going to be hearing a college newspaper case anytime soon. Actually, they had the opportunity with the Hoste v. Carter case in 2005 to grant certiorari, and they chose not to specifically. And so that was a very frustrating move by a lot of people in the college media world who thought this could be an opportunity to clear it up. But now that was 12 years ago, and we're in 2017, and not a lot has changed. So I think in emphasizing the importance of college newspapers, we need to push colleges to understand that if you want to have a college newspaper, you need to go all the way. You can't just half commit and have a newspaper that you feel you can control. In my article, I lay out a few pretty compelling arguments about the college setting in general, and I think these arguments sort of dispel any sort of thought that Hazelwood can apply to the college setting, although that was a pretty famous statement made in the Hostie case. They said college newspapers may very well be akin to high school newspapers, and I simply don't agree. One argument that I really enjoyed reading about in my research was a spheres of neutrality approach by Professor David Cole. And in this argument, he says that the government should afford a degree of independence to institutions and speakers, even if those institutions only exist because of government funding, toward the end of ensuring vigorous public debate. So yes, on one hand, these universities are doing a service by funding these newspapers, by funding student media, and for that we're thankful. But at the same time, just because they're contributing funding does not mean that they should have the editorial reins at all. It should really be an effort in making sure that they're fostering rigorous debate on their campuses and they're fostering trust in their student body. I mean, to me, it's baffling that a university would go to certain lengths to protect their brand, to protect their image. And it sort of creates a distrust in the student body on my end. I think that if you go back to the certain funding structures of particular student newspapers, some are half funded by student fees and some are half funded by the university. So at what point do the students' interest in getting fair press and fair and accurate reporting outweigh the university's interest in getting good press? And I think that's a question that the courts have not really wrestled with in terms of funding. So I think education and continuing to spearhead this effort and movements to let colleges know that if they value their student newspapers, they should make changes. But it can't just happen on the student end. And there's been several papers that have gone out on their own and said, we are declaring ourselves a designated public forum. And unfortunately, the way the analysis goes and the public forum analysis goes, that's just not enough. So we need to start to get administrators across the country and maybe the journalism schools of each school to help us work on this effort to enact change quicker than a court decision or even an effective law passed by the legislature, which there have been some great ones in recent times, but at least in a very pressing, more immediate term.
We have to leave it there, but I want to thank our guest, Nicole Comparato from the University of Miami Law Review, and encourage everyone to read her recently published note, Combating Institutional Censorship of College Journalists, The Need for a Tailored Public Forum Category to Best Protect Subsidized Student Newspapers. Thanks so much for that really valuable contribution to the scholarship, Nicole. And thank all of you for listening this month. Check out all the educational and legal resources we have for you at splc.org, and we'll talk to you next month.